Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Matt Forney. We're going to be discussing his coverage of the Iowa caucuses. Matt, great having you back on.
It's great to be back on, Robert.
So you started off with this idea to go to the Iowa caucuses, and you had a fundraiser to cover your trip. Was this your first sort of involvement with, would you say, sort of more conventional journalism?
I'd say more or less. I mean, my involvement with more conventional journalism began, I guess, in November when I was covering the Black Lives Matter protest here in Chicago. But I decided that, you know, I live here in Chicago. Iowa is about a six-hour drive to the west. We've got the caucuses coming up. People want, you know, and my firm belief is that this part of the internet, the alt-right, the manosphere, whatever you want to call it, should be engaged in more conventional journalism instead of getting our news from the media. So I suggest to my readers, you know, I'll go over here and cover the caucuses. I'll do a fundraiser because it's going to involve me. But, you know, going down to cover a protest in my city is nothing, but taking up roots and moving to a whole new state for a couple of weeks is going to cost money. So but my readers came through, and I was able to, while I was over there, I was following the campaigns around, going to rallies and campaign events, and I documented everything on my blog, YouTube channel, as well as at the rightonrightonnet, thecurrentthings.com. I'd say the project was pretty successful.
Basically, the Iowa caucuses are over, so the results came out. It was basically Ted Cruz won, Donald Trump came in close second, and Marco Rubio came in a close third. And Marco Rubio, he was pulling much lower in the polls, so there's the question. And you wrote about this. A lot of people are speculating about voter fraud because Microsoft counted the votes, and they're a top donor to Rubio.
Yes. The main thing is that this was broken by Breitbart a couple of days before the caucuses, but Microsoft was providing technology for to tally the votes in the Iowa caucuses, and that Microsoft is Rubio's second largest donor. It's a very suspicious situation. Also, on caucus day itself, there were a ton of irregularities and voting problems reported in several of Iowa's largest counties, such as Polk County, Johnson County, Dallas County, which are also coincidentally counties that Rubio won in the overall vote. The thing is, for all of the polls the past few months, Rubio was shown to be consistently at 10, 12, 15% of votes. He was a distant third behind Trump and whoever Trump happened to be dueling with at the time. He was previously Ben Carson, who the last month it was Ted Cruz. Rubio was a distant third. And also, I was on the ground, and I went to both Rubio events, Trump events, Cruz events, and I saw the turnout for myself. Trump was drawing overflow crowds consistently wherever he went. In fact, I went to a Trump rally in Pella, Iowa, and a Marco Rubio town hall in nearby Indianola on the same day. The Trump Pella rally drew about 3,000 people, which is pretty remarkable, in that Pella is only about population 10,000. In fact, there were so many people there that about two-thirds of the people who came to see Trump had turned away. They were put in the overflow auditorium, and Trump actually did a second rally for them. You know, they had come all the way to see Trump, and they couldn't get into the event to Trump to the second rally for them. But the Marco Rubio event I went to later drew maybe about 150 people at most, maybe 200 tops. Not only that, Trump fans were way more engaged. They were enthusiastic. They were serious. Whereas Rubio people just seemed like they were really bored all the time. They were just there because, oh, there's going to be a presidential candidate in our area. Let's go check it out. So Rubio coming up to basically nearly beat Trump in the popular vote in the Iowa caucus doesn't make a whole lot of sense, considering what I've seen and what the pollsters were reporting.
What was kind of like the overall sort of demographic profile of Rubio's supporters? Like, what was their sort of socioeconomic background? Were they young? Were they old?
It was basically old people, retirees. The only young people there were. It was being held at a college, Simpson College in Indianola, so you had a few college Republican types, but overall the audience skewed maybe median age 60. Whereas the Trump rally drew young, old people, middle-aged people, men, women, pretty much every demographic you could possibly think of was represented at the Trump rally.
Because the media is constantly saying that Trump supporters are all, like, old people.
Trump is the only candidate on the Republican side who's drawing young people. Old people is pretty much a descriptor of the rest of the GOP field. The only candidates who are attracting young people to their events and to vote for them are Trump and, on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders.
If you look at Marco Rubio and compare him to, like, say, Jeb Bush is an establishment candidate, but at least he's at least somewhat honest and upfront about who he is. Marco Rubio, what is truly despicable about him is he originally got elected to the Senate as being, he used the Tea Party and he said he was an anti-establishment guy. But he's truly, I mean, on pretty much every issue, Rubio is truly despicable. He's a warmonger. He wants to get us into more wars with Russia and Iran. He wants more to dramatically increase tech visas. He's for amnesty. He's just a totally despicable person.
Yeah, it seems like a bit of a stretch to make this comparison, but Marco Rubio is basically the Barack Obama of the GOP. They're much like Obama, Rubio's a one-term senator running for president. He's relatively young. He doesn't have a lot of money. And he's a cipher in many ways. He was for amnesty, then he was against it. He pretended to be a Tea Party guy so he could win the Senate race. Then he became an establishment candidate. You know, he's a friend of Jeb Bush's. He is an individual who is very easily controlled. And this was a point made by the conservative blog, The Last Refuge, which has been doing great coverage on how the GOP has been trying to rig the nomination to attack Donald Trump and support Jeb Bush. Rubio is a young senator, one-term senator. He's already stated that he's not going to run for re-election, even if he doesn't get the presidential nomination. He doesn't have much money. He has a lot of, political standards, he's got a lot of student loan debt. He is a person who will be easily controlled by special interests. I was interviewed by Magyar Hírlap, the Hungarian newspaper on the elections, and they asked me to provide a one-line descriptor of Marco Rubio, and I described him as Wall Street's favorite Ken doll. That's basically it. He's a good-looking, empty suit who will do whatever his corporate masters tell him to do.
You wrote this article, Donald Trump, Marco Rubio, and the Soft Bigotry of Political Correctness.
Yes, that was my account of going to both the Trump rallies and the Rubio rallies, because those were actually the first two campaign events I attended while I was covering in Iowa. Basically, the fundamental difference between Donald Trump and not just Rubio, but all the other candidates in the field, well, there are a lot of differences, but the one thing that strikes the root is that Donald Trump is the only candidate who does not, GOP candidate, who doesn't condescend to his supporters. You know, everyone keeps saying, talking about, you know, he's popular because he's anti-PC. Well, and he says it like it is. But the thing is, with Trump, I made this point that political correctness is in many ways it degrades people, mentally and spiritually, because being forced to acknowledge all these lies, it really does wear on you after a while. George Orwell made the point back in the 40s that he was commenting on goose-stepping, why in military dictatorships the soldiers, when they're out in parade, will march in this ridiculous fashion. And he said, basically, it's a way of taunting the people. Because if you try and point out how stupid the soldiers look, they're going to throw you in prison and shoot you. Political correctness has, in many ways, the same mental effect on people. You know, we know, for example, that blacks commit a disproportionate amount of crime, or women are not suited to serve in the military. But we have to deny all this, and if we say otherwise, we get accused of being racist, sexist, misogynistic, homophobic, transphobic, whatever. No, Donald Trump, in refusing to count out the PC, is the only candidate who's demonstrating that he respects his followers on a he respects his fans on a certain level, and he's not going to feed them a line of BS.
What was the racial demographics of the support for the different Republican candidates? Was it overwhelmingly white, or did some candidates appeal to more non-whites?
The only GOP candidate who really drew a large number of non-whites was Ben Carson. And this is mainly because I went to go see a Ben Carson town hall at Faith Baptist Bible College in Kankakee. There's a significant minority of Korean and South Korean and Chinese evangelicals who attend the school, and there were a lot of them at the Carson rally. That's really the only non-white I saw in large numbers. Well, this is Iowa, so there aren't going to be a lot of non-whites, period. That was the only time I noticed it, and mainly it's one of my friends theorized that Carson's mellow style is going to appeal more to Chinese and Asian evangelicals, just because they're not big on the whole pounding from the pulpit, fire and brimstone type thing.
Overall, Asians probably lean Democrat, but there's probably some niches like Christians or evangelicals who might lean Republican. But I guess it depends. Would you say the breakdown on Asian voters ties in with religion?
I'd say pretty much, yeah. I mean, I this is something I really can't comment on because there aren't enough Asians, there aren't enough minorities in Iowa to make an educated guess. But I'd say with the Asian evangelicals, they're going to go heavily. They go heavily for Carson, Asians are actually going to be moving in the direction of the GOP. In the 2014 midterm elections, the racial demographics, the GOP actually won Asians by 50-49%. This was Steve Saylor theorized that this was because of the response to the Democrats' response to the Michael Brown Ferguson incident. They saw the media and they saw the Democrats, they saw the left closing ranks behind Michael Brown, a criminal who had tried to rob a convenience store run by an Asian, and was he was portrayed as this martyr of police brutality. A lot of Asians saw this and they decided to vote GOP out of safety. It was a bit like the how during the Los Angeles riots back in the 90s. You had black riots destroying Korean-owned convenience stores in L.A.
What were some of your other observations of the Trump rally?
Like I said, the Trump supporters not only outnumber every other candidate, and that includes the Democratic side too. His events will draw more people than all the other candidates combined. That includes both Democrats and Republicans. But his supporters are the people who are most fired up. They're the people who are the most engaged in politics. They're the people who are the most. I would not describe them as angry. Trump supporters get cast stereotyped as angry white men, but the people there are not angry. They're concerned about the future, and they're looking to Trump as the best possible candidate to fix the problem. The only candidates whose followers really can match Trump's impassion are Bernie Sanders. But Sanders is mainly speaking to smaller crowds, and his crowds are more heavily skewed towards young people, towards college students. Another thing I would note about the Trump rallies is that a lot of the people Trump is bringing in people to vote who haven't been engaged in voting or the political process for a while because they recognize that both parties are not have been working against the interests of the average American. For example, and this happened repeatedly, Hannah Gertz, who is Trump's campaign co-chair and was also a contestant on the show The Apprentice. She introduces Trump at every rally, and she would ask the audience to see how many of them had voted in the Iowa caucuses before. And close to anywhere from a third to half of the hands went up. We're talking about people who are Trump is getting people who are turned off from politics because of back into them in a big way. And that's his remarkable achievement. Instead of tapping the existing GOP voter base, he's bringing in people. He's bringing in independents. He's bringing in blue-collar Democrats. He's bringing in people who are apolitical. That's a really remarkable achievement. That's been a great part of the reason for his success so far.
Yeah, that's the key. I think if you look on the left, I think the establishment left and the social justice warriors have a visceral hatred towards Donald Trump. And I think the reasoning is not so much because he's like the most right wing, but I think they see him as a threat because he can appeal to a large chunk of working class Democrats. But the thing about Trump supporters is they're not conservative ideologues like the Ted Cruz supporters or the Tea Party people. I saw some polling on Donald Trump supporters, and And on one hand, they said they're more likely to oppose mass immigration, but at the same time, Trump supporters are more likely to oppose, they're more likely to support higher taxes on the wealthy than other Republicans. So I think if Trump becomes a nominee, you could see a political realignment where a large portion of working class Democrats switch over to Trump. But I also think a large portion of the Republican establishment could switch to Hillary. So I could see a complete political realignment.
Yes. The main thing there is that there's way more people who will be switching to support Trump than who will be switching to Hillary to oppose him, just because Hillary, I examined the Democratic Party as well. Hillary is not popular at all. Her main advantages in this race are the fact that, you know, she's got the Clinton name behind her. She's a known quantity. And much of her support is based on the fact that she's electable. She can beat the Republicans. She's been trying to pound the idea that Bernie Sanders is not going to be able to do a – actually, at a rally, she actually attacked his masculinity by claiming that he wouldn't be able to stand up to the Republican attacks against him. But there's very little genuine passion for Hillary Clinton. That's why we see, despite the media being on her side, the party machinery on her side, despite the media trying to smear Bernie Sanders supporters with the whole Bernie Bros thing, she basically fights Bernie Sanders to a draw in the Iowa caucuses. She's losing the New Hampshire primary. People are looking for any alternative to her that they can get. And if they can get a reasonable alternative, you know, Hillary is going to go down very quickly.
And yeah, basically, her policies. Bernie Sanders is talking about, whether you agree with him or not, he's someone who's not controlled by corporate special interests. He's talking about dramatically different ideas. But basically, Hillary Clinton is running on a continuation of Obama's policies.
Oh yes. She's running up. She basically made this point in the rally I attended. She said we need to build on the great work that Obama has done. And the other thing about Hillary is she's running an incredibly divisive social justice warrior influenced wedge issues campaign. It's really a stark difference between. I went to a Hillary rally and I went to a Sanders rally the next day. Hillary mainly speaks about social issues. She talks about gay rights. She talks about transgender rights. She talks about another weird thing, issue she's taken up on is the case of HIV and the claim that insurance companies, healthcare companies are trying to gouge HIV patients with their medication. Whereas Sanders really only gives lip service to these social issues at best. His emphasis is on economics. He talks about the student loan bubble. He talks about campaign finance reform. It's fairly obvious. On social issues, he really isn't that different from Hillary, but at the same time, it's obvious that his interest is not in those subjects at all. And frankly, he probably wouldn't even address them if it weren't for Black Lives Matter trying to steal his microphone, or if it weren't for the fact that Hillary keeps trying to wedge issue him with these issues.
I know the Hillary campaign attacked his... he made this video for a campaign commercial where they used the song... America by Simon and Garfunkel, but the Hillary campaign attacked the video for basically like 98% of the people in the video are white.
Yeah, even though basically, VDare did a good analysis of this. They pointed out that basically all the previous Democratic presidential campaigns up until about 4 years ago were using similar imagery. Like John Kerry had a similar ad when he ran for president in 2004. Bill Clinton used similar ads when he ran for re-election in 1996. It's really it's basically Hillary's right now strategy is to try to smear Bernie Sanders as a closet racist, smear him as a misogynist. That's with the whole Bernie Bros thing. You have these supposed evil misogynists online who are harassing Hillary Clinton supporters. Turned out that was a completely fake story. The irony is that Bernie Sanders actually marched with Martin Luther King, and he was a supporter of civil rights his entire life. But right now Sanders was marching with Martin Luther King at the same time that Hillary Clinton was a Republican and a supporter of Barry Goldwater. Sanders has done more objectively for the cause of civil rights than anyone else in the Democratic field, and he was being part of the racist just because his emphasis is not on the social wedge issues, but on economic issues that affect everyday Americans.
You observe the different demographics between Hillary supporters and Bernie supporters. And Bernie supporters are mostly, you said they were mostly college students, and you said they were predominantly white. You also commented that the women who supported Sanders were more attractive. You said that Hillary supporters were mostly a lot of, like, older women, but you said a lot more minorities as well.
I qualify a lot more minorities. There was a larger minority. Well, again, this is Iowa. There are not a lot of minorities, period. But there was a larger minority present at Hillary's rally. There were a number of black women and a number of Hispanics. In fact, when I was waiting in line for the Hillary rally, the people in front of me were Spanish-speaking Latinos. Whereas at the Sanders rally, I think I only noticed maybe two black girls out of the entire crowd of 3,000. Basically, the Hillary rallies attract the Hillary people tend to break down into three different groups. You've got there's some younger feminists there who are supporting her because she's a woman and they want to see a woman in the White House. You've got older people who are nostalgic to Bill Clinton days, and you've got minorities. In the Sanders case, the demographic breakdown is basically college students versus older hippies, sort of flower power types.
What are your thoughts on Sanders' policies? Can you comment on his policies? Well, you listen to his speech. Can you comment on both his policies you find negative and the policies that you agree with?
I'm not a fan of Sanders' policies. If his program actually gets implemented, this country is going to be plunged into economic ruin. But on the one hand, I agree with him on campaign finance reform. The massive amounts of super PAC money, corporate money, Wall Street money, flowing into politics needs to stop. And it's noteworthy that both Sanders and Trump are the only candidates in the race who are not accepting money from special interests, because Sanders is only taking individual contributions and Trump is financing his own campaign out of his own pocket. And I agree with Sanders that something has to be done about the student loan issue. I don't agree with his idea that there should be free college tuition for the simple matter of the fact that if we gave free college tuition without some sort of a massive overhaul of the economic system, we're going to be encouraging people to continue to major in useless subjects that could contribute nothing to the economy. But on the one hand, I do actually agree with Bernie Sanders that we do need some kind of student loan jubilee, just simply because there's so much toxic debt being spilled into the system. I'm honestly got surprised that the student loan crisis hasn't caused another economic collapse like what we saw in the housing crisis back in 2007. My analysis of Sanders is that while I don't care for his socialist economic policies, I would much rather have him as president than Hillary, just because on a personal level, it's like I find Sanders to be weirdly endearing. It's like he's I remember him back from when I was a freshman in college. I was going up to college near Vermont, and that was when he was first running for the Senate. He's not a career politician. He is a career politician, technically, but he's not a psychopath like Clinton. I get the impression watching him speak that he really sincerely believes in what he's advocating. He's not looking to screw people over. He's a genuine political idealist, and that's something that's so refreshing when you see virtually every candidate just trying to triangulate for the largest possible voter base. Not only would I rather have Sanders over Hillary, I'd probably rather prefer Sanders to about a good portion of the GOP field as well, like politics.
I would vote for Sanders over Rubio.
Yeah, I don't think I'd vote for Sanders, but I would rather have Sanders as president than Rubio.
Sanders is also talking about the trade issues that Donald Trump is talking about.
Oh, yeah, that's another good thing I approve of Sanders. Well, this is something he's been advocating for his entire career in Congress. He knows that free trade has been very harmful to the average American worker. It's funny, I hesitate to call him a friend, but you're very close with Robert Lindsay. He had an article in which he basically said that he likes Trump's positions on trade, immigration, and taxes, and that Trump and Sanders are a lot closer on economics than most people seem to what other lights think. And I actually think, going based on what I saw in Iowa, that if Sanders doesn't get the nomination, but Trump does, a good portion of Sanders voters will cross over to Trump. And I actually think that if Sanders gets the nomination, but Trump doesn't, a good portion of Trump voters would actually vote for Sanders.
Well, that applies to me, because I plan on voting for Trump, but I would be open to voting for Sanders if it was Sanders versus Rubio.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. I would rather, like I said, I don't think I could pass a vote for Sanders. His economic policy as a whole is just too far to the left for me. But I would rather have him as president. I would rather have someone I disagree with, but you know, it's a bit like. But Alexander Hamilton's logic back during the election of 1800s, when he urged people to support Congress to vote for Thomas Jefferson over Aaron Burr, you know, to paraphrase Hamilton, you know, Sanders is not by far as dangerous a man as Rubio. You'd rather have someone with wrong principles in the Oval Office than someone who doesn't have any principles.
I think it's other issues. Sanders has a lot of good ideas about regulating Wall Street.
Yeah, that's another thing too, and that's there's also something that Trump has brought up, though not in such a degree. Trump's emphasis is more on nationalism.
I think with Trump, I think he's trying to sound a little bit more conservative on economics in the primary, but if he wins and makes it to the general, I think he could go in a much more stronger, like, economic populist direction. He's talked about getting rid of tax loopholes for hedge funds. He's mentioned that he would be open to some kind of, well, not Obamacare, but some kind of free health care for low-income people. So I could see Trump going in a more populist direction if he wins, and it's Trump versus Hillary.
Oh, yeah, basically. Trump's big success here is that he's been advocating in many ways for conservative ideas. But number one, he's not obsessing over all the other candidates are talking about tax cuts for the rich. He doesn't stick to that orthodoxy, which is part of the reason why he's so appealing. He's not explicitly saying that he's a conservative. That's another thing that you'll note when listening to all these candidates talk at their rallies. Rubio keeps trying to push the fact that he's conservative. Cruz keeps trying to push the fact that he's conservative. Trump never talks about the fact that he's a conservative. You know, in fact, his campaign slogan, "Make America Great Again." You know, it's something that's going to appeal to people across a wide variety of political people, because no one wants to live in a country that's defeated and weak. You know, everyone wants. He made this point during the power rallies, like, you know, liberal, conservative, Democratic, or Republican. We all want the country to be great. You know, and that's a great part of his appeal. He can advance conservative ideas. Can advance nationalist ideas, but without being labeled as such, which makes it much easier for Democrats and independents to support.
And a lot of conservatives, on one hand, they idealize the 1950s, but then they say if we raise taxes on the rich, the whole economy will collapse. But if you look at the tax bracket for the top income bracket in the 50s, it was like 90%.
Oh yeah, basically. Our economy was in many ways more outright socialist back then than it is now, and the country was prosperous. I mean, to a certain extent, some of the prosperity of the 1950s was due to the fact that the industrial bases of every other country had been bombed out by World War II, but at the same time, the fact that you have these policies in place means that, you know, you can at least say that they didn't hurt the economy. Having a 90% tax rate on the highest-earning Americans did not hurt the economy in any appreciable fashion.
And on the issue of immigration, I noticed in the early stage of the campaign, Bernie made a comment about tech visas, and he said that open borders are a right-wing conspiracy. But he started off sounding sensible, but then he was put under pressure on that issue, and Bernie has gone in a more pro-immigration direction.
Yeah, I mean,
that was an interview on Vox.
That was something that does make me a little nervous about Sanders, just because, you know, with the whole thing, for example, with Black Lives Matter, he had his microphone stolen from him by protesters, and instead of telling them to take a hike, or show some damn respect, he caves to them. You know, that's probably one of the reasons why I could not vote for Sanders. I mean, to a certain extent, I think he's just going along with the pro-immigration rhetoric and the Black Lives Matter rhetoric because he acknowledges that these people have more or less taken over the party, and he has to at least peel off some of their votes in order to, in order to win the primary. But at the same time, you know, Trump, to his credit, has stood firm, and he hasn't caved to, people who are trying to harass him.
That was also true of Jim Webb, who dropped out. Basically, when Jim Webb, he started off basically like sounding like Pat Buchanan, but he sort of flip-flopped on that issue later as well.
Yeah, Jim Webb's, all these other, all the minor candidates on the Democratic field, your Martin O'Malley's, your Chafee's, your Webb's never had a chance. You know, it was like Webb was trying to run to sort of represent the Democrats' working class base, but the problem is, the Democrats' white working class base has been chased out of the party the past few years because Obama's been...
I think Webb, ironically, Webb's demographics are the type of people who are supporting Trump.
Oh, yeah, basically. Trump is already, Trump is already hoovering up all these white working class voters. And from what I've observed, basically, if Trump wasn't in the race, they wouldn't be voting at all. Many of them wouldn't even bother to vote, period. Webb's, I actually kind of like Webb on a personal level. I thought his book on the Scots-Irish, the history of the Scots-Irish in America, is really good. But he's playing to a demographic that doesn't exist within his party anymore. Even as recently as 2008, there were still a large number of white working class voters within the Democratic Party. In fact, Hillary, was dependent on them for her success in the 2008 primaries. However, Obama's been running hard to the left with race war, Black Lives Matter, the whole incident with Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. And in 2012, basically Obama just jettisoned the white working class voter base at all and tried to appeal to minorities and to a lesser extent to upper middle class white progressives. There's no base by which Jim Webb or any candidate like him can see success in the Democratic Party anymore.
I actually think it would be interesting if Trump picked him as a VP, but I think he'll be pressured to pick a Republican.
I've made this point, I don't think I've made it publicly, but I made it to some other people. Trump may be forced to sort of compromise if he gets the nomination. He may be forced to make a compromise with the establishment wing of the party by nominating an establishment VP, which is basically what happened in 1980 with Ronald Reagan. George H.W. Bush was the preferred candidate of the GOP establishment then. Reagan beat him, but had to basically forge an alliance by having George H.W. Bush as his running mate in order to placate the establishment wing of the party. Otherwise, they would have probably tried to sabotage his campaign, like what happened with Barry Goldwater in 1964.
And then you have a Rand Paul who just dropped out. And I supported Ron Paul I was like a hardcore Ron Paul supporter in 2008. I supported him in 2012, but more kind of tepidly. But Rand Paul's been a he's been a disappointment. He squandered his father's legacy. And the reason Ron Paul was more successful, part of it was similar to Bernie Sanders in a lot of ways. Like he inspired people by his speeches, but also politically, he represented a sort of coalition of libertarians and more kind of populist conservatives. But Rand Paul has more sort of a part of it is part of Rand Paul's flaws is he sounded like a very kind of stereotypical politician. Like he made that comment that, oh, Donald Trump's not a real Republican. But then the other things he's done is he's alienated the more sort of a paleoconservative wing of Ron Paul's coalition who's going over to Trump. And he's also done stuff like the stuff he's done with Al Sharpton. So Rand Paul has been a complete failure as a candidate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I went to a Rand Paul rally that drew about maybe 300 people. I mean, I'll give Rand Paul's fans credit. Their devotion for the man is almost cult-like. I think a lot of it is just let people nostalgic for the Ron Paul days. But the main reason for the main thing that Ron Paul, Bernie Sanders, Trump all have in common is that they're outsider candidates who are not funded by special interests. So Ron Paul mainly relied on individual contributions, and also Sanders, Paul, and Trump mainly got their audience via the internet as opposed to traditional media channels. But the main reason why Rand Paul's has failed to attract the same people that his father did is because Paul has spent a good portion of his Senate career trying to cater to the left, like with the Al Sharpton thing. But at the same time, he's also rolled over for the GOP establishment in many ways. In an attempt to get more power for himself. So in many ways, he's tried to please everyone, and in the process, he ends up pleasing no one. And not only that, he's a very uninspiring public speaker compared to his father, who had issues, mind you. But I went to the Rand Paul rally. Rand Paul was the first candidate I saw on both sides who needed teleprompters in order to speak. He's got two teleprompters mounted on either side of his podium. When he's speaking, he looks at one, and then he looks at the other. He looks at one, he looks at the other. He doesn't react to the crowd. He doesn't look at the crowd. When they cheer, he could be talking to a brick wall for all it mattered. He's almost as bad as Obama when it comes to the ability to speak extemporaneously. He cannot do it.
His father he spoke from his heart. He inspired a lot of people.
Yeah, and versus, Rand Paul, basically, he gets the super libertarian types fired up. He gets the Ron Paul fanboys fired up. But both of those groups are vanishingly small. That's why, basically, Ron Paul was able to hang on throughout 2008 and 2012, having his followers who gamed the rules of the RNC to accumulate as many delegates as possible. Rand Paul has to drop out after the first contest because he has no support whatsoever. He doesn't have enough votes or money coming into his campaign to make his presidential campaign viable.
Then there's Ted Cruz, and Ted Cruz is the winner, and he's basically seen as the Tea Party candidate. And I've sort of observed the Tea Party movement from the beginning of its formation, but the Tea Party has always been just about their focus is mainly just lower taxes and opposing Obamacare, but they never tackled the sort of the big issues like trade that Trump is attacking. I never really saw it as a genuine populist movement.
Yeah, the thing with Ted Cruz is that in his Iowa campaign, he tried running to the right as hard as he can, particularly on social issues. His big thing for the last few months of the campaign was trying to attack Trump as being a New Yorker who is out of touch with evangelical concerns.
But the funny thing is his wife works for Goldman Sachs, and he took out a massive loan from them.
Yeah, he's against New York values, but he takes New York money. That was mainly the focus of the Ted Cruz rally I went to. It was geared around – it was being anti-abortion. This carried him to a first-place win, a surprise first-place win, I'd say, just because, like I said, the exit polls showed that Cruz was able to win the most conservative segment of the GOP voter base. But he had to basically pull all the stops to do so. There's how his campaign spread a false rumor that Ben Carson was going to drop out so he could get Carson's supporters. There's him potentially committing voter fraud. There's him burning his bridges with Trump. All the rumors that Cruz was angling to be Trump's VP, that's out the window now. He and Trump are not going to reconcile. And in the New Hampshire primary, next week he's going to get clobbered because the GOP voter base in New Hampshire is more secular, it's more libertarian. They don't care about the wedge issue. I'm not the first to make this comparison, but Ted Cruz is running a campaign similar to what Newt Gingrich did in 2012 to try to fire up the base by proselytizing and appealing to the narrowest segments as possible. Now that measure can get you a lot of support in the primaries, but particularly the primaries in earlier states that have more conservative populations like Iowa and South Carolina. But it's a path to absolute failure in the general election. Cruz has almost no crossover appeal with Democrats or independents. if he would have somehow become the nominee, he would lose to whoever the Democrats nominated in a landslide, just because he's such a divisive slimy individual. You know, he has no appeal outside of that narrow voter base.
And he's also flip-flopped on issues. He flip-flopped on the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Now he's emulating Trump's immigration stance, but a while back he said he'd like to increase he talked about increasing like tech visas by 600% or something like that.
Yeah, Cruz is basically he's your archetypical slimy politician who will say or do anything to get elected, and his the campaign tactics in Iowa showed this. But again, as I pointed out, he basically had to pull out all the stops, commit every dirty trick he could think of in order to get what is basically a narrow. You know, he got 29% of the vote, and he got 8 delegates, whereas, you know, that's just 1 delegate more than Trump got. He's not going to be able to what he had to do in Iowa in order to win Iowa is going to haunt him throughout the rest of the campaign. And the main reason the main reason he's going to stick in now is because going back to the allegations of voter fraud on the behalf of Microsoft and Marco Rubio, a good portion of Cruz's voters would probably defect to Trump if Cruz were to drop out of the race. So the GOP establishment is going to try to keep Cruz in the race as long as possible in order to divide Cruz's and Trump's supporters and give an advantage to Marco Rubio.
So out of the non-Trump candidates, which one do you think poses the biggest threat to him in winning the nomination?
Rubio by far, because Rubio is being maneuvered into the new establishment candidates. The GOP establishment's preferred candidate was Jeb Bush, but with what we saw in the past week, most of the brass is giving up on Jeb Bush. I went to a Jeb Bush rally. The guy only draws very small crowds of really old people who have nothing better to do. And his supporters basically, like I said, I described the demographics of the Jeb Bush rally I went to as being like a convalescent home field trip. Bush's results in the Iowa caucuses show this. He came in sixth and he got like 3% of the vote. So what we're seeing is the GOP establishment is giving up on Jeb Bush and they're shifting their support to Rubio. What I think they're trying to do with the goal of the potential voter fraud that happened in Iowa was they're trying to build up fake momentum for Marco Rubio to sort of position him as a surging candidate. They're going to try to either have Rubio pull off an upset win in the New Hampshire primary, or they're going to have him pull off a close second place finish. Right now, he's actually like at third or fourth in the polls. In New Hampshire, Ted Cruz is in second, but Donald Trump is way out in front. Like Donald Trump has 20 points on Ted Cruz in New Hampshire. And then they're going to try to have Rubio pull off a first place win in the South Carolina primary. Rubio is going to be I sort of joked about this a few days ago. It's like, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans could basically merge and rename themselves the Wall Street Party. The Wall Street Party is not going to – they're going to pull out the stops to make sure that someone they control ends up with a Republican nomination and with a Democratic nomination too. So Rubio is by far the biggest threat because he has establishment backing and because his voter base is more he has a wider appeal than Ted Cruz does.
Well, you have this article, How Jeb Bush Destroyed the Bush Dynasty and Tanked His Campaign. But on that topic, I think what is unique about Trump is he's the first major Republican candidate to really repudiate the Bush legacy. John McCain and Mitt Romney were apologists for George Bush. And Donald Trump actually came out and said George Bush was a total disaster as a president. I didn't even vote for the guy.
Yeah, that's the utterly amazing thing. Pretty much everyone has acknowledged, right and left, has acknowledged that George W. Bush was a horrible president. And Trump pulled a brilliant maneuver in embarrassing the GOP establishment by saying that, basically saying what everyone else thought, Bush was a terrible president. And in doing so, he basically forced them to, he trolled them into defending George W. Bush, and in the process making themselves look like a bunch of little wormy shills. Nobody, it's like, And this is a point that Trump made at one of the debates when he was attacking Jeb Bush. You know, it's like Jeb Bush keeps trying to urge the point that George W. kept us safe, yet 9/11 happened on George W.'s watch. You know, it's a completely, to anyone with a grasp of reality, you know, it's like the GOP, the people who are defending George W. Bush look like they're completely insane.
You also read about Carly Fiorina, but she's someone who's pretty, she's pulling pretty low. I mean, how relevant is she now?
The only reason I went to her particular campaign event was because I had to go to Iowa City anyway I was going to go to a Ted Cruz rally later that day, but I decided to go to a Trump rally instead and go to a Cruz rally the next day. But I went to the Fiorina event because it was on the way. Fiorina was always a joke candidate. The surge in the polls she saw a few months ago was because of basically the conservatives were looking for any candidate possible to sort of fight Trump, and they settled on Fiorina for a while based on her supposed performance at the GOP debate. But basically, she was not able to sustain that support because, you know, she has no national constituency. She's trying to run as a conservative, but her credentials for doing so are being the former CEO of HP, a company which she almost ran into the ground. And when she was ousted as CEO in 2005, HP stock price had basically cratered. And also her first attempt at running for political office in 2010, when she got the Republican nomination for the Senate, she ran against Barbara Boxer. She lost, and she lost hard. You know, and that was a Republican wave here. We saw the GOP take back the House. We saw them take back the majority of governorships. We saw them take 6 Senate seats. And not only did that take seats in the Senate, but they took Barack Obama's old seat in Illinois, and they took they defeated Russ Feingold in Wisconsin, which is a pretty liberal state. So there was no excuse. Despite Republicans having a huge swing to them in that election, Fiorina loses to Boxer by 10 points. She has no her run for president is basically a vanity run. You know, she's doing it, it's scaling upwards. And as of right now, her poll numbers have collapsed to the point where she's relegated to the undercard debate.
And you also wrote about Chris Christie and the death battle of the Rockefeller Republicans. The point you're making is Chris Christie is one of the last Rockefeller Republicans. I hear that term a lot, but how would you sort of define the ideology of a Rockefeller Republican?
They're basically, back in the 50s and the 40s, the Republicans, after, you know, basically being in the political wilderness for 20 years, the Republican Party in the Northeast decided to give up on being conservative, give up on being an opposition party. Instead, they decided to be more left-wing than the Democrats. The term Rockefeller Republican comes from Nelson Rockefeller, who was governor of New York from 1959 to 1974, I believe. He was actually a pretty good governor, objectively, but he was an incredible liberal and an internationalist, and who massively expanded the state during his tenure as governor. The Rockefeller Republicans were really the dominant wing of the Republican Party from the 40s through the early 60s. Thomas Dewey, who was a forerunner of the Rockefeller Republicans, was the nominee for president in 1944 and 1948. Rockefeller himself ran for president in 1964, but he lost to Barry Goldwater despite having more money and name recognition because the party was starting to get sick of the Rockefeller Republicans and was moving in a right-wing direction. And over the course of the next 10, 15 years, we saw all the major Rockefeller Republicans lose to primaries in primaries to more conservative candidates, or they would just lose the general election. They're an extinguished wing of the Republican Party because they have no appeal outside of the North. They have no appeal to the Southerners, the Midwesterners, the more conservative Southerners and Midwesterners, who now comprise the GOP base. Chris Christie represents the Rockefeller Republican strain, governs from the left during his time as New Jersey governor. And while he may be a good fit for New Jersey, he has no appeal to the actual GOP base. You know, the idea of him being a presidential candidate was pushed by the left-wing media because they knew that he would not be able to appeal to the base. Ergo, if he gets the nomination, he's going to lose to whoever the Democrats nominate. In fact, during when Christie was running for re-election in 2013, the media actually helped his re-election campaign by suppressing negative stories about him. For example, the Fort Lee Lane closure scandal, that mysteriously did not break out into the news until after Christie had been re-elected, despite the fact that the media had known about it for months beforehand. He's someone who is, I mean, I put it this way in my article. Chris Christie's presidential campaign is a practical joke that everyone's going to want to accept him.
And then you had the neocons, they became dominant in the Republican Party. They peaked in the Bush era right around the time of 9/11. Started to rise in power during the Reagan era. Do you see their influence as on the decline?
Their influence has basically all but fallen through the hole in the past 2 years. They're not going to go down without a fight, though. That's why you see. That's why you see a lot of them lining up behind Rubio now.
They have the money. They're small demographically, but they have like billionaires like Sheldon Adelson who will back them up.
Yes. In fact, Sheldon Adelson, if I recall correctly, he's actually went back in Cruz, which is another parallel to the Gingrich campaign. Gingrich was heavily backed by Sheldon Adelson in 2012 to the point where Adelson was almost single-handedly funding his campaign near the end. They're not going to go down without a fight. And Trump represents the best chance to oust them from power altogether, just simply because he's refused to take their money. You know, he made a good point when he was speaking to the Republican Jewish Coalition. You know, he said, I want your support, but I don't want your money. Basically, you get a lot of the neocons. Trump himself is pro-Israel, and I thought that his daughter actually converted to Judaism when she got married. He doesn't strike me as someone who's anti-Semitic, yet he's being smeared as an anti-Semite because the neocons don't want, even though Trump would probably be willing to work with them, they don't want someone who's just going to work with them. They want someone they can control. Trump is someone they cannot control.
Yeah, like on his foreign policy, Trump is pro-Israel. Trump is very much against the Iran deal. But on some issues, he has gone against the neocons. He's defended Putin and said, let Russia deal with ISIS. And the neocons don't like that because the neocons want to see Russia out of the Middle East, and they want to see Assad toppled. So he has shown some independence on foreign policy.
Yeah, I mean, Trump's foreign policy is the only one out of the cabinet that makes the most sense. He's basically saying, well, we shouldn't have. The neocons are incoherently want to both defeat ISIS and defeat Assad. And Trump is making the fair point that we can't do both at the same time. You know, we have to pick a side, you know. Right, which one is the bigger threat to us right now? Is it ISIS or Assad? And Trump's basically saying that it's ISIS because ISIS is a group that's on the advance. They're fueled with American money. They're recruiting people. They're recruiting Americans and Europeans, to fight for them. ISIS is the bigger threat. We should focus on ISIS. We should work with Russia to take care of ISIS because they've been doing a pretty good job of it so far. I mean, we spent the past 4 years hand wringing over ISIS to gain from the Middle East. The Russians come in, they basically have the ISIS on the run in under a week, you know. The neocons, on the other hand, want to pretend that it's still 1985, we're still in the Cold War, Russia's the big bad, you know, and we have to go to some sort of conflict with them, which would be absolutely suicidal.
Do you think that if Trump loses, what role will he play? Do you see him as being, because he is, Trump does have a kind of, he's the kind of person who, he does have a vindictive side to him, and I'm not necessarily saying that's a totally bad thing. I think it can be put to good use, but do you see him as either running third party or using his immense wealth to kind of stir up trouble for the Republican Party if he loses and they screw him over?
I don't think he can run as a third party candidate at this point because many of the GOP primaries and caucuses require anyone who wants to compete in them to sign a loyalty pledge. Trump may break it, but I think Trump can stir up trouble even without doing anything. Because if Trump does not get the nomination, or if he gets the nomination but he loses it due to foul play, his supporters the bulk of them are either going to vote for the Democratic candidate as fight, or they're just not going to vote at all. So if Trump, if the GOP tries to keep Trump from getting the nomination fair and square, we are going to have another Democrat in the White House. Simple as that. Trump is the only candidate who is capable of taking the White House back from the Democrats, from the radical left. If the GOP tries to block him from doing so, they're basically signing their own death warrant. That's why you see some characters such as Chuck Grassley and Bob Dole are sort of warming up to Trump now. They realize that if they piss him off, he doesn't have to do anything himself. His supporters are just going to desert the party in droves. They realize that that Trump gets the nomination fair and square, they're going to have to back him, or otherwise there won't be a Republican Party left.
Do you see Trump's run as playing a role in expanding the Overton window and sort of benefiting dissident movements like the alternative right?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, before Trump entered the race, it was pretty much, this is just an example, it was pretty much accepted before Trump entered the race that we were going to see, we were going to have comprehensive immigration reform, we were going to have amnesty. In fact, the front runner for the nomination was Jeb Bush, who is explicitly in favor of amnesty, and it's called Illegal Immigration, an Act of Love. Now, with Trump entering the race just a couple months later, not only is building a border wall acceptable, not only is deporting illegal aliens acceptable, we actually have the federal government talking about Republicans in Congress, talking about punishing sanctuary cities like Chicago, who explicitly give aid and comfort to illegal aliens. That all that happened in the span of a couple of months. Trump has expanded the Overton. Trump's comments on Muslim immigration have, has done a similar thing. You know, it's like he brings up the common sense idea that we shouldn't be letting in Muslim immigrants for the time being, since we're technically at war with a Muslim state. Even if Trump doesn't get the nomination, he's done an immeasurable service in pushing the national dialogue further to the right. In fact, he's actually, as you mentioned with Ted Cruz trying to ape Trump's position on immigration, he's also encouraged the other candidates to be more conservative as well. That's even, you could say to a certain extent, even Bernie Sanders has sort of been influenced by Trump.
So we basically have covered all the major candidates. Before I wrap up the show, could you touch briefly basically on how the Iowa caucuses work? You have an article on that.
Well, basically, I interviewed Joseph Dobrian, who is a writer based in Iowa City, and he also serves as a Republican caucus leader for his local precinct. Basically, the Republican caucus is very similar to a traditional primary. The main difference being is that there's no absentee voting. There's no early voting. If you can't physically show up to the caucus, you don't get the votes. You just vote for the candidate of your choice, and they tabulate the votes, and then they apportion out the delegates based on which candidate getting a certain percentage of the vote. The Democratic caucus is more complicated. When the Democratic caucus goers have to separate into groups, form preference groups based on their individual candidates, and then they vote. A candidate in the Democratic caucus has to get at least 15% of the vote in order to be considered viable. If they don't get 15% of the vote, they are eliminated. What happens after that is that their supporters, they take another vote. What happens is a candidate who gets eliminated his supporters may try to ally with some of the other groups in order to ensure to give them more support. Or several minor candidates might try to band together in order to send an uncommitted delegate. So there's a lot of shuffling around, a lot of horse trading. It's kind of an interesting process from my perception because I'm from New York. I live in Illinois now. Most people live in states where the nominations are determined by primaries. A primary election is pretty simple. It's the same as a general election. You walk in, you cast a vote, you leave. So a caucus actually involves a good deal amount of brain power and a good deal amount of involvement in the political system. That's why Joe Topian says he prefers it over the primary system because it gets people more engaged and also attracts people who are more engaged politically.
So we are out of time. Matt Forney, it's been a great show.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. Thanks for having me on again, Robert.
Thanks again for being on. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.